Well, do you know what, Heather? Page one is page two, because page one was the readings. Oh. We've just had those. So if there was another page of this, it would be, you'd be here till the evening. Please don't worry at all. Sorry, some things are sent to try us, aren't they? Do you know, you're going to remember the visit of the Bishop of Dorking, aren't you, for all the wrong reasons. And I'm going to remember that you guys have a sense of humour, and I'm very, very grateful. So it's the Feast of St. Michael and All Angels today, and I thought it would be good to address that topic. You've just heard two pretty dramatic readings. How do we talk about what we know and cannot see, what we perceive and cannot touch, particularly when the stakes are really high? So you've just heard about Nathanael under the fig tree, who says to Jesus, when Jesus compliments him and says, "You're a really good guy, in you I can see no deceit." And Nathanael, the empiricist, says, "How do you know? How do you know?" And Jesus replies and says, "I was watching you under the fig tree." And it seems that for Nathanael, I'm guessing Nathanael the scientist, that answer is sufficient. Jesus is saying, "I did some careful empirical research. I have evidence for what I'm talking about. I was watching you under the fig tree and I checked my sources." And at that point, Nathanael is ready to respond to Jesus that he is King of Israel and Son of God. In other words, to make a non-empirical response, to which Jesus replies, "You ain't seen nothing yet, baby." Our age is really poor in language and conviction for the realities that lie beyond what we can see. Empiricism. We're materialists. We have to touch it. We have to hold it. We have to see it. And we're very hesitant to acknowledge a world that is beyond our senses. Now, if we do, and some do, it's about ESP, or it's about wizardry, or it's about mediums. But for Christians, it's about heaven and a new heaven. It's about angels and demons. Christians are those who've been given to know what lies beyond this world, beyond what we see, beyond the immediate. We are those privileged to know how the story of this world ends, in the triumph of good over evil, in the triumph of Michael and his angels over the great dragon, as we heard from the Revelation reading. Yet with all of that inner knowing, I dare say we're hesitant and we get embarrassed voicing language about angels and particularly demons, language about good and evil in battle. After all, we're modern people. Aren't those just old ways of talking about, I don't know, the human psyche, made colourful with a little bit of superstition and some old-fashioned beliefs and ceremonies, right? Wrong. I want to affirm the old saying that there is more to this world than meets the eye. That's what Jesus says to Nathanael as he approaches him under the fig tree. I suspect we all know the struggle between that which gives life and that which takes life. It's ongoing and ever-present, probably in our households, as well as in this community and more widely. Humankind has had stories and images aplenty in every age and culture to discuss and conceptualize that struggle. How it began, who are the players, what are their sources of power, and what are their limits? If I had a penny for the times I hear a Christian say, often hesitantly, I'm not one of those to see a demon behind every bush, and yet there is some kind of spiritual struggle going on, I think. But how do we work out what that is? Will we make it worse by naming it? And what if we're wrong? What if we're unsure about the cosmology behind that struggle? Have we committed to something dodgy? And more ultimately, does our cosmology, does it stand up? Is it robust enough to handle the really tough stuff? Instead of a robust cosmology, I fear we've instead dwelt on a vast array of consumer features that give us a sort of sentimentalized picture of angels. An angel will pop up on your computer screen when you're on some mail order website to offer to help you and to text you if necessary. At one point, angels had their own shops, as far as I was concerned. Do you remember past times with those Michelangelo angels on every tray and every apron and every t-shirt? I'm getting some smiles. They went out of business. Or go to the University of Surrey campus this very weekend. My niece started there yesterday, where a freshers angel will pop up the minute you arrive in your car to direct you to your parking and to help you unload your stuff. Angels on one level are everywhere, it seems, yet for all their ubiquity and humour, there's an enormous gulf between how angels are depicted here and their true reality. So, the book of Revelation makes clear that the earth is inhabited by many spirits, some beneficial, and shall we say, some malignant. What makes a spirit an angel is that it's a messenger, angelos, from God, and as such has specific characteristics. Reading from a book called Angels Unawares, Megan McKenna writes, "Perhaps we can best describe angels by what they do rather than how they look. Angels instill in those who see them or hear them a violent need to obey the truth. Since they stand always in awe before God and worship God, no matter what they've been charged with doing, the presence of the holy exudes from them. Sometimes angels have been described as ways by which human beings apprehend the presence, the knowledge, the will of God. Angels, she says, are evidence that God is taking notice of us." And then Walter Wink, in a book you might know called Unmasking the Powers, describes the invisible forces that determine human existence. And he notes that in the book of Revelation, John's letters are addressed to the angels of the seven churches, not to the vicars, not to the church wardens, but to the angels of the seven churches in Asia. And he contends that all churches have an angel, a spiritual entity that represents the whole of the church's members and experience. Similarly, all institutions, we might extend it, have an angel. They have a withinness, a spirituality that defines them. So we might say the University of Surrey, I don't know, has a spirituality or an angel that looks like a student union student. What does Holy Trinity Westcott have, besides Heather, of course? The print angel. What does the Diocese of Guildford have as its angel? The angel shapes the culture and is the projected being of the institution. What is that here? You will know much better than I, but I do know it includes laughter. I think it might also include something about enabling the ministry of all believers. If you walk through these doors, you get involved, you're put to a job, you're asked to search out your vocation. You may end up at a BAP. I think I saw two people last year. Wonderful. And can this angel, this is a bigger, tougher question, can this angel change if it is the spiritual projection of a community that is diseased, that is not well? It's probably easier to name that in other institutions than in our own household. It's hard, isn't it, not to think of our processes of government at Westminster just now. Can the angel change? I think one only has to look at the story of South Africa during the 80s and 90s to say, yes, it can change, but not without conscious, serious spiritual battle. Battle with things seen and with things unseen, which we must be ready for. The reading from Revelation tells us of the great battle in heaven where the malignant is confronted by the good, by the healthy. Michael is the leader of the forces of goodness and truth. Gregory the Great notes that Michael's name means who is like God, Michael. His mere presence is an eternal reality check. It's also Michael who stands guard at the gate of Eden, we're told. His name and presence, the constant reminder that there is no God besides God. No one, neither subtle serpent nor power-hungry human, who can stand before the Holy One. Michael makes clear the boundaries. He's the protector of the human race, charged with helping it to maintain its discreet, distinct character and nature, its position within the web of creation, just a little lower than the angels, given charge over creation, dominion, as God has dominion over human and angelic kind, dominion that seeks life and truth, nurture and abundance. Throughout the ages, Michael has come to the aid of those who struggle against the spiritual forces of wickedness that corrupt and destroy the people of God. That great war in heaven, it is said, began at the moment that God first breathed life into humankind. The angels are at the bottom of a heavenly hierarchy, behind thrones, seraphims, cherubim, dominations, virtues, powers, and the lowest orders of principalities, archangels, and then angels. The angels are given the task of assisting them. The angels were also given a choice to move with God's desire or not. And the war resulted from those who thought the humans too far beneath them to serve. It's their unwillingness to cast to earth. And immediately, those spirits were cast forth from heaven, set out to subvert God's desire for humankind and lead them into the same traps of seeking power over others and one another, to seek the place of God without the power of holiness. Just as those angels were expelled, so too were humans, both in the same realm with the same burden of alienation from God and from one another. And so a hallmark of human institutions whose withinness, whose spirit is directed by those malignant spirits is, I put it to you, their inexorable trend towards alienation or dehumanization. Let's return to the example of South Africa for a moment, because I think it's really instructive, but I know it well because I lived there for a brief year. In the struggle for human rights, the church was at the forefront of the process of naming the social evils and the malignant spirits, most chiefly of apartheid. Both active and passive participation in those structures shaped the spiritual landscape of the whole country. But what distinguishes South Africa's struggle is the anti-apartheid's leadership in keeping non-violence at the forefront, exposing the violence of the South African government. And then following transition, 1994, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission then took the stand of radical forgiveness and reintegration. That is, the sheer weight of the suffering, the self-sacrifice, the urgent need to tell the truth, to set at liberty the captives and open the eyes of the blind, to name sin, to make restitution, and to forgive and to proclaim forgiveness and the holiness of God's presence. The insistent struggle, despite the oppression of the police and the unspeakable horrors inflicted on black South Africans in particular, those speak of Christ's love. It's on that ladder of Christ's ministry, death, and resurrection that we discern the spirits and the angels, and we see Christ's spirit incarnated in so many South Africans, those who were willing to bear the cost, those who climbed a spiritual ladder and laid down their lives in many cases for that cause. The steady presence of the angelic hosts bore down relentlessly there against the spirits of those who sought to usurp the place of God, conferring human or non-human status on the children of God. Against those vast forces of goodness and light, the shadowed spirits of apartheid could not stand, and even now are being transformed into an angel, a messenger from God to all the nations, bringing hope to our beleaguered world. If this most desolate of all places, South Africa, could experience transformation and justice and love, the justice and love of God, so perhaps also Bosnia, Pakistan, South Sudan, Myanmar may one day too see healing. We pray. Perhaps our nation too, our nation presumably post-Brexit, whenever that may be. But I fear for us that the battle has a long way to run yet, and possibly a lot more damage will be done. So how might such transformation happen? It will not be by a magic wand, but by costly confrontation, determined non-violence, patient, persistent, generous truth-telling. If the church will be the church, that fully human, fully divine mystery whose vocation is to announce and live in the presence of God, establishing God's reign and healing God's children from all the forces seen and unseen that seek to rend and destroy. But it's a challenge, isn't it? We don't feel up to it, do we? We're not strong. And perhaps we've fallen out of practice in discerning the spirits. But acknowledging that our starting place is imperfect, being impinged on all sides by the struggle between light and shadow, and that our choices are not always Christ-like, this day, the Feast of St. Michael and All Angels, invites each of us to examine the angel of our household, our church, our institution. If Jesus watched us under the fig tree, would he be able to say, "Here are true Christians in whom there is no deceit"? Or put another way, does the angel that holds our group spirit project the self-giving, healthy, hopeful, clear-eyed, truth-telling, destabilizing, laughter-filled love of Jesus? As Christians, we're given the ground on which we can undertake the most rigorous self-examination, because forgiveness and assistance to mend the broken and heal the wounded is ever present in the cosmos. It's at the heart of the web that holds our life together here. It's in Jesus Christ, in whom was no deceit. In Jesus Christ, the compassionate. In Jesus Christ, heaven and earth are reunited. In him, we can ally ourselves with all the spiritual forces of good. In him, we are called to join the heavenly battle, which does exist and must be enjoined daily in all our choices. And then, like Nathaniel, we will be known, seen, and shown more than this. We will be shown the angels ascending and descending upon the Son of Man.